There's a domestic dimension to everything we just discussed about military readiness, and it's this: the oversight mechanisms that Congress uses to evaluate whether the Pentagon is actually prepared for these new threat environments are being quietly disabled. Republican senators, not Democrats, Republican senators, took the unusual step this week of publicly scolding Defense Secretary Hegseth for cutting Democratic members of Congress out of classified Pentagon briefings. The senators involved included members of the Armed Services Committee, which is the body constitutionally responsible for military oversight. Their complaint wasn't partisan grievance, or at least, the most credible version of their complaint isn't partisan, it's institutional. The whole point of the Gang of Eight briefing structure and the broader committee briefing structure is bipartisan by design. Intelligence oversight has operated on a bipartisan basis, specifically because national security decisions require legitimacy that survives changes in administration.
And there's a practical dimension here that sometimes gets lost in the political framing. When members of the minority party are excluded from classified briefings, they lose the ability to fulfill their oversight function. But they also lose the ability to credibly defend administration decisions when those decisions become public. Bipartisan briefings create bipartisan accountability. Unilateral briefings create unilateral accountability, which means that when something goes wrong, it goes wrong exclusively on one party's ledger.
For Hegseth specifically, this is part of a broader pattern. He's made a series of decisions that have created friction with the uniformed military and with Congress, and each time the friction has come not from the opposition party, but from within the coalition that supports the administration. That's a different kind of political problem. You can dismiss opposition party criticism as motivated, but you can't as easily dismiss criticism from your own side. The Republican senators who spoke out today aren't renegades. They're committee members with jurisdiction over the issues Hegseth is managing. When that group says publicly that you're conducting yourself improperly, that's a signal the White House should be reading carefully.
And speaking of the White House, Trump's statement about 2028 is worth examining carefully. He told reporters he'd love to run, but that the law is very strong, which represents a meaningful evolution in his public positioning. For most of the past year, he'd either deflected the question, made jokes about it, or suggested through surrogates that constitutional scholars had differing views. This was more direct. The law is very strong is a concession, not a dodge.
It matters for succession politics more than anything else. The moment a sitting president says clearly that he won't seek another term, even in a term that doesn't begin until January 2025, by our reckoning, the race to position as his successor begins in earnest. And the Republican field for 2028 is already quietly organizing. The people who have been holding their ambitions in check are going to read this statement as permission to begin. What makes it complicated is that Trump's influence over the Republican Party doesn't end when his second term ends. He could endorse a successor. He could withhold endorsement as leverage. He could endorse and then retract. The 2028 Republican primary is going to be substantially shaped by what Trump decides to do with his post-presidential influence, which historically has been enormous.
There's also the New York gubernatorial race to watch as a leading indicator of national Republican momentum. The new Siena College poll shows Governor Hochul leading Nassau County Executive Lee Blakeman by 10 points, down from 20 points in June. That's a 10-point compression in about 6 weeks. For Hochul, the concern is that New York isn't supposed to be competitive. If she's working to hold a 10-point lead in August of an election year, she's spending resources and political capital on defense when she should be generating surplus. For Blakeman, the closer question is whether a Nassau County executive can translate a suburban base into a statewide coalition. Nassau has trended Republican in recent cycles, but it doesn't automatically follow that a suburban Republican wins upstate and in the outer boroughs.
The Maine Senate race is its own story. Democratic challenger Jackson is now responding to a police report from 1988, 38 years ago, showing he punched a man and pushed his partner in what appears to have been a domestic altercation. His partner from that incident is now publicly denying that the assault occurred as described. In a tight race, a story like this can swing a point or two, which in Maine's current Senate dynamics could be the whole ball game. The strategic question is how Jackson's campaign handles it. Denial, contextualization, and apology all carry different risks. His partner's denial gives him room to contest the characterization of events while acknowledging that something happened. That's probably his most defensible ground.